KZSU, Stanford University, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, and thank you for listening in today. Today I'm doing a rare, relatively rare, live conversation, and I'm very excited to have on Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School. Mark is one of the foremost intellectual property law scholars in the country today, a prolific writer. I could probably spend the next hour listing his publication credits alone. But one of the great areas that Mark is particularly an expert in is patent law. And patent law is something that I've discussed on the show in some detail with David Olson and with other guests as time has allowed. But particularly today, it's a good time to have Mark on because patent law has rather suddenly, although we may talk a little bit about whether how sudden it is, has entered the forefront of the Supreme Court's docket with several cases of varying import to not only people in the intellectual property law world, but technology generally in the business world. The Supreme Court has come up with a number of cases brought up on cert that have run the range of patent law issues from what is patentable to what relief you can get with patent violations. And we're going to talk about some of that today with Mark. And indeed, one of the cases that we'll be discussing, Microsoft v. AT&T, which we'll be discussing a little bit today, was in fact argued in the Supreme Court just this very day. We're on this air live today at 5 o'clock Pacific time. So the argument has already concluded and we'll be able to get Mark's initial reaction to what has been discussed in the court. Mark, among other things, is widely recognized as a preeminent scholar of intellectual property law. And as I was saying, is quite prolific, having published over 70 articles and 6 books. He's also a litigator and has tried cases before the Supreme Court, the California Supreme Court, and federal district courts. He's affiliated with Kiker and Van Nest up in San Francisco, and before joining the Stanford Law School faculty in 2004, he was a professor at UC Berkeley, Bolt Hall, and the University of Texas School of Law. He also clerked for Judge Dorothy Nelson at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Why is patent law something that would be of interest not only to intellectual property law scholars, but also to people interested in technology generally? Well, as we've discussed on the show numerous times, intellectual property, for better or for worse, has become increasingly important not only in terms of the general idea of intellectual property, which is to capture the value of the work and creation that you, in fact, have put in your time and effort to create, but also it's become a lightning rod for a lot of concerns regarding how things are created, what incentives are necessary to allow creation, what controls should people have and businesses have and inventors have over their creations, as well as a general question of property itself and what do we mean when we say property and what, in fact, where is property's role in the world of creation. It's a very wide-ranging issue. It's one of the reasons why I got interested in intellectual property as a law student, because of all the challenges issues involving everything from the First Amendment to how businesses run. So I'm very excited to have Mark on today to discuss patent law, intellectual property law, and generally perhaps some discussion about how Mark got into these areas, and ultimately to have a very timely and, like I said, quite rare live discussion about patent law. So when we return from a short music break, I'll come on the air with Professor Mark Lemley of Stanford Law School on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Mark, on the other side of the glass, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. And let me make sure that I am able to hit the button correctly. There we go. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Now we are. Okay, the sticky button of the analog board falls me again. Thanks for coming today and joining me on Hearsay Culture. Let's start right off with kind of a little bit of your background. I'm always curious with guests about how they got interested in the topic we're discussing. So beyond what I said, how did you get interested in intellectual property and technology law, and what do you see as your current main focus?
Right. Well, I didn't come to this with a scientific background, unless you count political science as a science, which I'm reliably informed you don't.
Right.
I studied economics and got interested in antitrust law and competition policy. And when I went to law school, I did some work on the interaction between antitrust law and intellectual property, because there's a complex relationship between the two. And that drew me in the early 1990s to Silicon Valley. And in Silicon Valley in the early 1990s, the place to be was intellectual property law.
So it was one of those things where geography had a major impact in where you are today.
That's right.
In terms of your focus right now, I mean, I mentioned patents, and for obvious reasons, that's a major area of interest generally, and I know it's one of your major focuses. But what else do you consider yourself to be focused on right now?
Well, I'm doing a lot of thinking about patents and the reform of the patent system, also still about the relationship between intellectual property and antitrust law, and also internet law, particularly as it relates to copyright and trademarks.
So is there a unifying idea or theory that brings you interested in these various subsets of intellectual property?
Yeah, I guess in all of these areas, the question is, how do we best promote innovation? And that, in turn, I think requires a balance. There are a lot of people on both sides who think we ought to get rid of intellectual property altogether, or everything should be owned and intellectual property rights should be perpetual. And neither of those, it seems to me, actually is likely to best promote innovation, because you got to have rights in order to encourage people to create, but you've also got to have space for people to tinker with those creations.
The one of the areas that we've discussed on this show, as I mentioned in the introduction, is the realm of innovation and the questions about why people create what they do. And I want to come back to that, because I think running through many of the cases that we'll discuss today is ultimately this question of why do we have patents and what are patents supposed to promote. I do want to ask you a few more relatively personal questions vis-a-vis your role as a scholar, which is a question I've asked a number of people I've had on the show, which is activism. There are many people who consider themselves lawyer activists. Now, I certainly aspire to be a bit of an activist. There's certainly some areas of law that I'm quite passionate about. But I'm curious to know, your writing has run the range from focusing primarily on technology to focusing primarily on intellectual property and merging the two. You've written articles that are both quite practical in their focus and quite theoretical. So I'm curious, do you consider yourself an activist?
Oh, yeah, at least from time to time.
Uh-huh.
It's one of the hats I wear.
And in terms of being affiliated with a law firm, how do you merge the world of scholarship and being a scholar with being also a practicing attorney? Because as I mentioned, and as many of the listeners know, you've argued numerous cases. In fact, you've been counsel to a couple of the parties to the cases that were currently pending in the Supreme Court. How do you balance those two roles?
Well, in terms of time, I mean, I am first and foremost a professor at Stanford, and that's my primary job and it's my primary interest. But I spend one day a week practicing law, and I get some interesting cases, and there's a synergy between the two. You get cases that cause you to think about things in ways you haven't thought about them before, and bringing the broader academic perspective, I think, actually makes me a better lawyer.
And I think it's something that as I enter the academic world for having practice, it's something that I'm weighing myself. And indeed, I should have mentioned actually for in the quasi-disclaimer mode that you're also, I think, my boss. It's fair to say because among Mark's many hats, he's also the director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology, and the Center for Internet Society falls under that rubric. So, you know, again, now there may be listeners that say, well, now this guy's interviewing his boss, and now where are we going to go? But I will maintain my journalistic integrity and push back, even though, like I said, technically I think Mark is a boss of mine.
Well, it's also worth noting you've got another job already.
That's true. That's true. So, yeah, there's less of a hook, perhaps, to my activities now. Well, let's turn to patents. And for the listeners that aren't familiar, maybe you could do your nutshell, couple-of-second description of what a patent is and then how that fits into the world of technology.
Sure. I mean, a patent is a legal right to control an innovation or an idea that we give as a matter of government policy to the first person to come up with that idea. And the rationale is that if we don't give them some sort of exclusive right to compensate them for the money they spend on research and development, everybody will want to be an imitator. Nobody will want to be an innovator.
And patents in terms of what is patentable is one of of the major challenges that we're going to be discussing. But before we get into the specifics of some of the cases, can you give the listeners some examples of the range of items or things that are patentable under the law as it exists today?
Yeah, so the answer is it's hard to think of something that somebody could create that isn't potentially patentable. The statute passed in 1952, Congress said was intended to cover anything under the sun made by mankind. Mm-hmm. And in the last several years, we've really seen that play out. So DNA sequences are patentable subject matter. A method of exercising your cat with a laser pointer or a way of holding your golf putter can be patentable subject matter.
Right.
Computer software can be patentable subject matter. And most recently, business methods, purely non-technical inventions. The concept for Federal Express, guaranteed overnight package delivery, had it been invented today for the first time, would have been patentable.
Is it fair to say, and this kind of gets us a little bit into some of the discussion we're going to have, that the breadth of what is patentable has expanded in recent years?
Yes, absolutely. I think in the 1970s, we had a much narrower conception of what was patentable. It was limited to what the court called the technological arts.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen expansions in biotechnology, in software, and in business methods, primarily from the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which is the intermediate court that has jurisdiction over all the patent cases.
And that's the Federal Circuit Courts, that's a relatively recent development in the jurisdictional issues. Am I correct?
It's been around for 25 years now.
Yeah. But patents, of course, go back to the Constitution.
Yeah. One of the first statutes passed in the very first Congress in its first month of creation was a patent law.
Right. And so it's an interesting development on the jurisdictional side, which I think, were this a show focused purely on law, perhaps we get into a little more detail there. Let me ask you one more overview question before we get into some of the cases, which is, I've had a number of people on the show who focus on copyright particularly, or trademark and trade secret. As you know, I've focused on trade secret recently in my scholarship. And there's often a question as to how much overlap there is as between the, I would say, four, although many people would say three, major areas of intellectual property. To the extent that this can be a short answer before we get into cases, what is the overlap between patents and, say, copyright?
Right. Yeah, so the answer is, traditionally, you would have said patents cover inventions. They cover the technology that you might develop, and copyrights cover creative things. They cover works of art, books, movies, that sort of thing. That line is starting to blur as we expand patentable subject matter, but there are a lot of things that you'd never see covered, protected by copyright, that are scientific creations, there are engineering creations, and vice versa. I think while we're seeing some efforts to patent things like screenplay ideas or plots for novels, that's still primarily in the realm of copyright. So we're seeing some blending of the line, but they've traditionally had their own separate domains.
And I guess the last overview question, which is, for those people that are listening whose interest is purely on the technology side, in the sense that they are not intellectual property scholars, or indeed they don't know a lot about intellectual property, there's a lot of press about copyright, and that's fairly well known, and certainly we're at a radio station which plays music, so there are a lot of people quite familiar with the issues involving copyright and fair use and copyright and downloading and things like that. For people that aren't as familiar with patents, why should they be interested in what we're about to discuss involving the Supreme Court cases and patent law?
Right. Well, so I think there are two reasons, right? One is, we created the system because we believe it's what drives the innovation that makes places like Silicon Valley great, that without some kind of patent system, we wouldn't have the technology companies and the technology jobs that employ so many of your listeners. The other thing, though, and it may get a little more personal at this point if you work in the technology industry, one thing lots of people don't know about patent law that distinguishes it from every other area of intellectual property is that you can be liable for infringing somebody's patent even if you've never heard of them or their product. So unlike copyright law or trade secret law, where it's taking something from someone else that's the problem, patents give people rights over the invention itself, and even independent development of the same invention is no defense.
And so the sharing of information that exists, the you know, what's become a cliche, so I won't use them, but the ability of the internet to allow people to gather information from various sources, in fact, in some ways, is it fair to say, could lead to more patent infringement simply because people could be independently working off relatively the same amount of information and wind up going in the same direction?
Oh, and I think that's not only possible, I think it's the most common kind of patent infringement. Lots and lots of inventions in society are developed independently at about the same time because there are changes in economics or there are changes in resources that make it available. And in fact, if you go back and you look at all the canonical inventions you learned about in elementary school, right? The light bulb, the airplane, the laser, the computer, on and on. Every single one of them was, in fact, a case of simultaneous invention where there was a contest, a fight over who was the inventor, who got the patent, and somebody else who was an independent developer lost out.
It's an interesting conundrum that I think we face with technology, because unless we're going to filter the information that gets out there, you're going to run into these things, and hence the law has to sort them out. And I think with that kind of background, why don't we get into some of the cases? I guess a brief overview would be, and it would be an unfair question, I think, to virtually anyone except you to be able to say, can we quickly – There are about a half a dozen cases in the Supreme Court. For just in a 20-second soundbite, what are the cases and what's their main focus? And then we'll get into a few of them.
Right. Yeah, the Supreme Court has taken more patent cases than in any time since I've been alive. And I think there are a couple of unifying themes, but the primary unifying theme seems to be all of these cases, it looks like the court has taken them to cut back on what it perceives to be expansive patent rights, that it thinks the system has gone too far and gotten out of whack.
And in terms of the cases themselves, we're dealing with cases that literally were argued today, like the Microsoft case and cases that were decided this past summer.
That's correct.
Okay. Let's jump into – I'm basically going to take them in somewhat of a random order, but I do want to start briefly with the case that was described, that was discussed today, although we don't have to spend a lot of time on it, which is the Microsoft v. AT&T case, which was argued today in the Supreme Court. What was that case about?
Well, so this is interesting. If you'd asked me that question yesterday, I would tell you that this case was about a pretty hyper-technical issue of patent law, specifically the question of whether a patent that grants rights only in the United States could lead to worldwide damages when Microsoft sells its Windows program in Europe, or whether there has to be a separate patent in Europe to try to get those damages.
Right.
But based on some things that were said at the oral argument, this case may take on a much more significant tone, because it looks like several of the justices and all of the lawyers, both the lawyer for Microsoft, the lawyer for AT&T, and the lawyer for the U.S. government, seem to agree that software wasn't patentable. And that's something that no patent lawyer would have told you yesterday. Software has been clearly patentable since at least 1998, and most of us have understood it was patentable since the 80s.
So it's interesting, as we do have the benefit today, and this is a good opportunity to actually have a live show, we do have the benefit to actually get what certainly would be your first impressions of what's happened, because we've looked at the Patent Leo blog just before we went on the air. Let me read you one comment that's reported on the Patent Leo blog, which for the listeners that aren't familiar, Patent Leo is a blog that Dennis Crouch puts together, where it's a great blog for covering basically everything going on in patent law at a given moment. And what he does quite well is to summarize cases. So using the modern technology we have here, and I'm actually going to slide the mic over, which is a big no-no, but I wanted to scroll down a little bit in the entry and read you a colloquy which kind of opens up the question, where Justice Stevens apparently asked, your time is up, but I want to ask you one more question, yes or no. In your view, is software patentable? And Mr. Josepher, who's representing in this case a party that wouldn't have said, standing alone in and of itself, no. Now, that's not, as you said, what was predicted would be a focus of the discussion. I'm curious to know, again, with the big caveat that you haven't had the opportunity to delve any more deeply than what I just mentioned into what was discussed today, what do you think's going on there?
Well, I think that the Supreme Court, as I said, is concerned to cut back on it, what it perceives to be the expansive scope of patent rights. Mm-hmm. We have, as I said, developed in the last 10 or 20 years a pretty common understanding that software is patentable, and there are hundreds of thousands, literally, of software patents in force in the United States right now. But that understanding was developed without the Supreme Court's participation. Mm-hmm. Last time the Supreme Court took a case on the patentable subject matter issue relating to software was 1981. And it may be, as I think we see in a lot of Supreme Court cases, that they're interested in what their prior precedent says. They're not interested in what the courts of appeals have been doing for 20 years. And so they may take us back to 1981, to a world in which software wasn't patentable unless you could invoke what I call the doctrine of the magic words. You could call it something else, a pizza mm-hmm. oven or a some kind of hardware device that happened to have software in it.
Right. The controversy surrounding software patentability is one that has gotten a fair amount of attention. And I'm curious, for the benefit of the listeners, how recently has it been, or put another way, when did the court start deciding that, in fact, you could patent code? Which is really what we're talking about here, because based upon the standard definitions that we've considered in the past and what you mentioned at the beginning, it would seem that software wouldn't fall under the kinds of items that we would want to patent in the first place, both from a policy perspective perhaps, but also from a statutory perspective. So when did this develop?
Well, after the Supreme Court's decision in 1981, lots of people filed software patents. They just didn't call them software patents. Mm-hmm. And that led to a number of problems. And then gradually people started to whittle away, the courts started to whittle away at the question of, well, how much hardware is actually required? And we decided that a ROM chip that was programmed with software was new hardware, and that was okay. Mm-hmm. Then we decided that any computer became a new machine once you loaded a new computer program in it, because after all, the orientation of the gates open and closed was different in that computer once the program was loaded. And finally, in 1998, the Federal Circuit threw up its hands and said, this is silly. We've been patenting software for 15 years. We've just been pretending it's something else. That pretending is not doing anybody any good, and so we're just going to tear the veil off and say, look, we're patenting code.
It's and it seems to continue with a colloquy right at the top of the entry on the Patent Leo blog, which I'll also read for the benefit of listeners to just gauge your reaction to. So Mr. Olson from Microsoft says, the 580 patent is a program, as I understand it, that's married to a computer, has to be married to a computer in order to be patented. Justice Scalia says, you can't patent, you know, on-off code in the abstract, can you, as a question? And the response is, that's correct, Justice Scalia. Justice Scalia says there needs to be a device, and the response is, an idea or a principle, 2 + 2 = 4, can't be patented. It has to be put together with a machine and made into a usable device. To me, this seems like, as you mentioned, a very significant colloquy. But it leads to the following question, which is, if we're taking from this oral argument that the court's going to be going in these directions, what can we say, and this is a crystal ball question, and so the other caveat I always throw as a former current litigator, I always say, I hate the crystal ball question, you're asking me to predict the future, who knows? What do you see as the significance of this kind of colloquy and this kind of interest at the Supreme Court level in terms of its impact now on lower courts that are going to have to think about these issues?
Right. Well, I mean, the caveat is a good one, right? It's really hard to predict from oral arguments what the Supreme Court's going to do.
Right.
But I think there are a bunch of signs, not just in this case, but also in a case called LabCorp versus Metabolite, mm-hmm. that the Supreme Court is showing interest in the breadth of patentable subject matter and that it is particularly interested in narrowing that breadth. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of complaints about problems with the patent system, about bad patents issuing, about so-called patent trolls who buy up patents and use them to extort money out of legitimate operating companies. Lots of those complaints are concentrated in the software and the information technology industries, and it may be that the court will get rid of those problems in one fell swoop, though doing so also gets rid of a lot of the incentive to innovate in these industries.
You mentioned Metabolite, and I think actually this is a good time for a very short break. And when we come back, we'll discuss the Metabolite case because, as you said, I don't want to ask too many crystal ball questions. We can get on to discuss some things that actually have happened and that we can draw some conclusions from. You're listening to KZSU Stanford, Hearsay Culture, Dave Levine interviewing Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford Law School. We're back on KZSU. I've been using some jazz breaks today because I was saying to Mark, I had a really hard time figuring out what songs I could find that would be patent songs. And I was thinking about maybe, actually, as I was thinking about it, even on the air, I was thinking maybe Funny Inventions would have been a good one. But be that as it may, we're using some great classic jazz there today. And you probably recognize Monk's Mood there just before the break. Before we continue the conversation with Professor Lemley, I do want to do what I always do this time on the show, which is to ask you for money. As you know, KZSU is a non-commercial radio station that's dedicated to music, sports, public affairs, and other types of programming, and it needs your support to continue being on the air. So if you're interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a number of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can call the station at 723-9010. So we're back with Professor Lemley, and the button seemed to work crisply and smoothly right there. So let's talk about Metabolite. You mentioned that in our discussion about Microsoft. What is the Metabolite case?
So this is a case that presents another patentable subject matter question, this one involving natural phenomena or products of nature. And I should note at the outset, I represented the patent owner in this case, so I'm not an unbiased observer.
Fair enough.
The inventors in that case discovered that an elevated level of total homocysteine in the human body was strongly correlated with deficiencies in two vitamins. So they then did what you might logically think you would do, which is they constructed an assay that tested for total homocysteine, and if it was above a certain level, they diagnosed a vitamin deficiency. Mm-hmm. They patented that test. The question is, you can't patent the natural phenomenon itself, the correlation in the human body. Mm-hmm. Could you patent the implementation or the use of that newly discovered natural phenomenon to create a diagnostic test? Now, the court didn't ultimately end up answering the question. I think everybody in the patent bar had assumed up until the Supreme Court took the case the answer was yes. Supreme Court was very interested in it, and both from the oral argument and from a dissent from three justices, it looks like they would have said the answer was no. This is not the kind of thing they believe that should be patentable.
This case turns us to the direction you mentioned earlier about method patents. And I guess the question I do want to ask at the top level is this an example, in your view, of a method patent that we're dealing with?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Right.
And in terms of where the court's going with that, based upon its holding, what does that say about the breadth of business method patents as we sit here today?
Well, I think that we're going to see, whether it's in Microsoft versus AT&T or in some other case that comes before the court, some serious cutting back on the scope of patentable subject matter. Whether you think that's a good thing or not depends, I guess, on whether you believe we'd still get inventions of this type in the absence of patent protection. And, you know, people have different views on that question.
We should, I think I'd be doing listeners a disservice if I didn't ask you your view on it. So where do you come down on that?
On this particular question of discoveries, the problem, it seems to me, is it's really hard to draw a good line. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's true that the real heart of the invention that the doctors came up with in LabCorp was a discovery of a correlation in the human body. But that's also true of Prozac. Right, the inventors of Prozac made a discovery that a certain class of chemical, selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, interferes with the depression pathways in the human brain. They then did what you might logically expect someone to do. They put that chemical in the form of a pill and they gave it to patients. But I think we need patents on the pharmaceuticals. Right? And the fact that those pharmaceuticals are developed from a discovery of a natural phenomenon shouldn't make them any less patentable, or we're not going to get pharmaceutical invention.
The debate about innovation and why people innovate is a good one, and I think it's an interesting discussion. I want to probe your views a little bit about it in the context of patents. One of the arguments that I've made, which I know you're familiar with in an article I had in Florida Law Review, is the idea that patent law in some ways is more democratic in the sense that more information gets out there because of the publication aspect of patent law. But yet, we also know, and in fact you've pointed out to me and others have pointed out, that in fact the law isn't all that perfect and that there are a lot of ways for information itself to be obscured even while you present a patent application and go through the prosecution process and get it approved. In terms of innovation itself, my question is, how much of the publication element of patent law is either an aid or a hindrance to innovation?
Right. Well, so the basic theory of patent law, as I said, is we give you money for research and development. But there's been a subsidiary theory for a long time, which is that the grant of a patent, because it requires you to publish your invention, contributes to the storehouse of human knowledge. And I think there's something to that, but it's hard to say how much, in part because people have grown adept at writing patent applications that in many cases conceal more than they reveal. Mm-hmm. That's especially true in the software and the information technology industries. So there's not, I think, a cadre of scientists out there reading patents to learn their science. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the patent publication requirement encourages people who would otherwise have kept the information secret to publish it in other venues, to put it in a journal, to talk about it at a conference. And so we get more information that way. Mm-hmm. The other problem, though, is some of the legal rules we have right now actually discourage people from reading patents. And so especially in the electronics industries, your patent lawyers will tell you, for goodness sake, don't read a patent. Right? Oh, no good can come of it.
because of where?
Because of a doctrine called willfulness. Uh-huh. As we said earlier, you can be liable for infringing a patent even if you're not aware of it.
Right.
But if you become aware of it, you've then got an obligation to go consult with a lawyer, get a written opinion explaining whether or not they think you would be infringing this patent to continue doing what you're doing. And if you don't get that opinion and or sometimes even if you do, you could be liable for triple your actual damages if you continue to use the invention after you've learned of the patent. And so a lot of companies tell their scientists, don't read patents. You could get us into trouble.
The other area, which it's a rough segue, but I do want to mention it because we discussed it earlier, and it's kind of a good time for it, is the issue of patent trolls, which are the entities, businesses that purchase patents that may or may not be utilized at a given moment, and then attempt to exact rents by way of license fees and what have you from other parties that may want to use some or all of that patent. There's a debate there too, isn't there, regarding whether in fact trolling is such a bad thing. And in fact, you and I have been present at some symposia here at Stanford where that debate came up. What's your view on patent trolling itself in the context, again, of the innovation element that exists in intellectual property? Is trolling a bad thing?
Right. Well, so part of the problem is a definitional problem. Nobody knows who a patent troll is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the original concept is it's the person who sits under a bridge, the monster who sits under a bridge they didn't create and pops up and forces passersby to pay a toll to get through. And I think we do see quite a bit of that. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there purchasing and enforcing patents they didn't themselves create. There are a lot of companies, even if they did create the patent, maybe they're not successful in the marketplace, and so now they're simply in the business of suing other people who are successful in the marketplace for patent infringement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is some value to having patents in the hands of entities who can't themselves compete in the marketplace, but who can transfer technology legitimately to others who can, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sale of the idea, the market for technology is valuable. But I also think there's an awful lot of litigation abuse that's in the system. In part, that comes out of what the patentee can threaten. Right. If you're Intel, your microprocessor may have 5,000 components in it that are potentially patented. You own some of those patents. Your competitors own some of those patents. And you and your competitors will usually come to a deal because they own some patents that cover their technology, too.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people out there own patents, and they wait until your invention is on the marketplace, and then they threaten to shut it down,
mm-hmm.
The entire chip, because it's got one circuit in it that's covered by their patent. And that can lead to some extortionate settlements,
right.
Especially when you couple it with the surprisingly high cost of litigating a patent case.
Which is always a factor, and in fact the Chilling Effects world have taken a look at the litigation aspects that go into patent enforcement. It's a topic that I'd like to discuss, but I think given time, I don't think covering the issues that we should cover without talking about some of the other Supreme Court cases, including the next one, which is one where, again, you represented one of the parties, and MedImmune v. Genentech. Again, that's also a case dealing with some procedural remedy issues. So what was that case about?
Right. Well, so that's one of the things that people have said they want to do about the patent troll problem is create more opportunities to challenge bad patents, to weed them out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways you can challenge a patent if you think it shouldn't have been issued under the current system is you can file what's called a declaratory judgment action,
mm-hmm.
And say, I think this patent's invalid. And the Federal Circuit has had relatively restrictive rules for when you can file such an action. In this case, in MedImmune versus Genentech, and I did represent the patent owner, Genentech, and the case is still ongoing, so mm-hmm. I want to make it clear that these are my opinions and not Genentech's.
Fair enough, and I won't press you.
The patent owner, Genentech, had entered into a license agreement with MedImmune. And a license agreement is, if you think about it, really a settlement of a lawsuit that hasn't happened yet,
mm-hmm.
right? I promise not to sue you for patent infringement, and you promise to pay me a royalty when you make products that might infringe the patent, assuming the patent's valid. MedImmune then tried a new strategy. It said, well, we're going to keep the license agreement in force. You can't sue us for patent infringement because we're paying you royalties, but we're also going to sue you and try to get your patent invalidated.
Hmm.
And the courts below said, no, you can't do that. There's no legitimate controversy here. Supreme Court said, yes, you can do that. And so I think we're going to see a wave of people who are in existing license agreements challenging the validity of the patents at the heart of those agreements, because there's really no cost to doing so.
And the litigation aspects also kick in, and we're moving rather quickly, but eBay and KSR are two other cases that have come up. And in the remaining 7 or 8 minutes that we have, about 10 minutes, eBay and KSR.
Sure. Yeah, both of these, I think, are bound up with this question of patent trolls and
right.
bad patents and the perception that there are a lot of bad patents out there and that they're causing mischief. In eBay versus Merck Exchange, the patent owner was a non-manufacturing entity. We can argue about whether they are a patent troll, who owned a business method patent. And they sued eBay and won. But then the district court said, I'm not going to stop eBay from running its online marketplace. You may have to pay damages to this patent owner, but we're not going to shut down the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The Federal Circuit said, no, that's not right. You've always got to grant injunctions once you find patent infringement. And the Supreme Court reversed that decision and said, you got to look into the facts of each case to decide whether an injunction's appropriate. And so far, this happened in May, so far we've seen a dozen or so cases from the district courts applying that standard. And they've bunched quite neatly into two categories. If you are a competitor in the marketplace as a patent owner, you always get an injunction against your competitor. If somebody's infringing your patent and it's taking sales away from you, you get to stop them from doing that. Mm-hmm. But if you're a non-manufacturing patent owner, if you're a troll or somebody who's trying to get licensing revenue but not actually a participant in the marketplace, then the courts have said you're not entitled to an injunction because you don't need it, because all you really need is money, and you can get that money through the award of damages.
These cases all seem to have an interesting thread, it seems, which is to ultimately focus, I think, more on the practical side of what the law is doing to particular businesses and the ideas and the ability of those businesses to propagate the ideas in the market. Am I right about that general theme?
Well, maybe. I mean, I think the court believes the patent system is out of whack and it needs to be reined in and brought into balance. I agree with that in substantial part. But then the question is, you can't just sort of start cutting back randomly on rights, right? Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that the tailoring you do, the limitations you create are the ones that are going to get you the right results. Mm-hmm. So I think, for example, that a decision like eBay, which says we can engage in a case-by-case analysis of whether you actually need an injunction, is a lot more valuable in getting the patent incentive correct than saying no software can ever be patentable or no discoveries of natural phenomena can ever be the basis of a patent, right? Because you can't do any calibration in that latter case.
Right.
So my worry is that, you know, the court sees a broader problem and its solutions won't necessarily be tailored to what I think of as the litigation abuses of the patent system rather than complaints about the system as a whole.
In the remaining about 5 or 6 minutes, I do want to ask you kind of a follow-up, sum-up question, which is, again, quasi-crystal ball, which are there any cases that you're familiar with that are winding their way through the lower courts that you think people should be taking a look out for as potential for going up to the Supreme Court level and in the patent arena?
Yeah, well, I think things are going to continue to change. We didn't get to talk about the KSR case, which mm-hmm. may be the most significant.
And why don't we do that?
Yeah. So one thing we might look to see is a change in the standard of obviousness. This mm-hmm. is the legal test of how different does my invention have to be from what came before in order to justify giving me a patent.
Right.
And there's widespread belief that the Supreme Court's going to tighten up that standard, make it harder to get a patent.
Mm-hmm. And obviousness meaning for the benefit of the listeners, what is that standard?
Yeah, how different my invention has to be from what came before.
The differences between the inventions themselves.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I think we'll see some interest in the overlap between intellectual property and antitrust, especially in the pharmaceutical industry. There is a practice of paying your competitors to stay off the market, which works because the FDA regulates who your competitors can be. Mm-hmm. And so you can split your monopoly profits with the potential entrant and keep drug prices high. The courts have so far been reasonably willing to allow that practice, but I think the Supreme Court may be interested in intervening. We will see about that. Mm-hmm. There also may be some efforts to try to create a little more uniformity in the doctrine of patent claim construction, which is a process by which we figure out what patents actually cover, right? What do they mean, and that seems to occupy a disproportionate amount of the time of patent litigators.
The KSR case, yeah, I definitely see how its significance is profound. But for the benefit of the listeners, why is it that you see that case as being the most important case from the standpoint of people looking at patent law and technology today?
Right. Well, so I think for good and for bad, it's the single policy lever that is most going to determine how many patents there are out there, who gets those patents, and how strong those patent rights are. Virtually every lawsuit involving a patent meets with a claim that this invention shouldn't have been granted because it was obvious. Mm-hmm. And so a change in that standard – doesn't just affect the limited number of cases that involve software or involve injunctions after a finding of infringement or whatever else. It changes the rules of the game for every case. And it changes the rules of the game in the patent office. And so it may affect whether these patents are ever issued in the first place.
In the last couple of questions I want to ask, which are kind of top level, beyond patents, we haven't talked about the other areas that much, but I do want to ask you, what do you see as the leading challenge in the intellectual property world generally right now? What do you think is the really hot button issue that, again, people looking in the technology sector in particular should be interested in?
Right. Yeah, so beyond patents, I guess I'd say two things, right? One is globalization. We have legal systems that are national in boundary. We have been slow, especially in patents, to turn those systems into global systems. But commerce is clearly global. And so what you do, especially with software that can easily flow across borders content, digital content and piracy, I think is going to determine significantly the way in which the creative industries operate in the next next decade. The other is related, which is the influence of the internet. And that's especially true in the copyright and the content side. We have a bunch of industries who have had business models for 50 or 100 years that clearly aren't going to survive another 20 years. And the question is, given that the business model isn't going to survive, is the industry going to survive? And if it does, how is it going to make the money? Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't, what kind of content are we going to have?
There's so many great issues, and I would invite you back for some time in the fall, perhaps, once I've moved on to my next job. And for those of you that aren't familiar, it's now up on Larry Solom's blog, but I accepted a tenure track full-time position at Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. For the fall, I'll also be a non-resident fellow here at CIS at Stanford on a going-forward basis. And for those of you listening to the show, to be absolutely clear, this show will continue. KZSU actually has asked me to continue doing the show, and I'm thrilled to do it. So the show will continue even though I'll be on the East Coast. It'll be aired here on KZSU, and we're working out the logistics now. But with regard to where we're going, I think the last question I really want to ask you, which is the overarching question, which is the intellectual property scope, if you will, has been driven, at least in the public's mind, on this issue of the content industry, quote unquote, versus the software creators and the people that are innovating on the technology. So we have the cases that people are familiar with involving Grokster and the cases that involve piracy abroad, which you mentioned. From the public's perception, I think one could get the impression that there is very much a polarized world in intellectual property. There are those that are only for rights, being very strong and dominant, and then there are everyone else wants to change and undermine the entire system. In terms of your view of what the public is seeing, how accurate do you think it is to read what has been publicly said about these issues and make a true determination about where intellectual property law is today?
Right. Well, so I think the answer is, it's right to say there are a lot of people in both of those camps. Mm-hmm. And the rhetoric you hear on the Hill, the rhetoric you hear in the media, is quite often of that character, right? It's apocalyptic on both sides. And the important thing to remember is this is, at the end of the day, government regulatory policy, right? What we're aiming for is balance. Mm-hmm. Right? We're not aiming for give the copyright owners everything, because that's not going to give us the best content and the best use of that content at the end of the day. But we're also not aiming for all information must be free, because we know that nobody's going to make the Lord of the Rings movies if they can't make money from them.
Right.
And so the key has got to be to try to find that middle ground. And a lot of people screaming on the wing feelings on one side or the other make it awfully hard sometimes to occupy that middle ground.
Do you see us getting to the point where we are increasingly finding that middle ground? Are you optimistic, in other words, about where we're headed?
In patent law, I'm reasonably optimistic. In copyright law, I'm not so optimistic. I think the legislative process in copyright law went off track a couple of decades ago and hasn't particularly come back. I think the courts have not been a particularly good check. And what we've seen in the opposite is a move by technology companies and by a lot of citizens to do their best to opt out of the system altogether, so that rather than working together to create a fair and balanced system, if you'll forgive my using a term that Fox News claims to have trademarked, rather than creating a system that's in the center that serves the needs of everybody, what we see are a really, really draconian copyright system that lots and lots of people ignore completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a fair and balanced way, I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and doing a live show, coming across campus. I'm very excited and thrilled to have had you on today, and I do invite you back once I'm doing a show almost exclusively by telephone, as I'm sitting on the East Coast and you'll be sitting probably right here in the Bay Area. Thank you, Mark, for being on today.
Thank you, Dave.
I want to thank Mark Lemley, Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford, for being on today. It's always great to have scholars of his renown and knowledge on the show, and it's especially fun today given the argument in the Supreme Court to get Mark's initial reactions to what's going on. The show is being recorded, is being done live today, Wednesday, the 21st. Please stay tuned on KZSU for Mike and Baptism of Solitude. And additionally, I do want to mention, since it came up, that yes, I am still at Stanford, and I'm still a resident fellow. However, in the fall, I will be taking a tenure-track position teaching at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'm excited to go back to the East Coast, where I'm from, and teach relatively close, if not directly, in the Research Triangle in North Carolina. But I do want to assure those listeners, all of you who are weeping right now at the thought that Hearsay Culture would somehow disappear, and I'll flatter myself and believe that there's someone out there that might feel that way, and say that, in fact, the show will continue. KZSU has been a wonderful venue for the show, and I'm very pleased to say that KZSU has asked me to continue doing the show, which I will more than gladly do. I have a lot of fun doing the show. I hope all of you have enjoyed listening to the show and enjoy listening to as much as I enjoyed doing it. So the show will continue. As always, you can find out more about Hearsay Culture by going to hearsayculture.com. You can also get the show by podcast, or those of you listening on podcast, either through hearsayculture.com or the podcast feed on the CIS webpage, or lastly, by going to iTunes and clicking and finding the Hearsay Culture, the Center for Internet Society webpage, where you'll be able to find Hearsay Culture as well as other great programming. I will gladly take any comments and questions you have with regard to the show and with regard to future guests. I'm very much looking forward to next week. I have done an interview with David Brin, author of the book The Transparent Society. That was a fun and wide-ranging interview, and I'm looking forward to airing that next week. And then the following week, I'll be having Professor Richard Epstein on from the University of Chicago, who will be a recorded interview. He's currently a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I'll be very pleased to talk to Professor Epstein and get his views of the world. You can always find the schedule as well by going to Hearsay Culture. So thank you again for listening today. Thank you again to Mark for being here and taking his time to fill us in on the world of patent law. Please stay tuned to KZSU for Mike and Baptism of Solitude, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.